The Heart Aroused, Poetry and Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America. This one's called Spirituality in the Workplace. What is it? Why it matters? How to make it work for you? The Reinvention of Work. Zen and the Art of Making a Living. It's only too late if you don't start now. Mindfulness and Meaningful Work. Heart at Work. I could do anything if I only knew what it was. Live the life you love in 10 easy step-by-step lessons. What color is your parachute? Making a living without a job. Winning ways for creating the work that you love. Now, I could have brought in maybe 500 books like that. Many people read these books. And some find what they're looking for. Some people read these books and make the changes that they need in their lives, that they're longing for in their lives. Follow your bliss. Find the work you were meant to do. In 10 easy steps. But often, it's not as simple as these books make it out to be. When I think about the number of books there are in the stores or on Amazon these days, I say, what's going on? Why are people staying in jobs that don't feed their souls? Why are people holding back from doing the kind of work that is meaningful for them? Of course, there are practical reasons. Obviously, you need the money. Or you're only 5 years from retirement. Or you don't know if you're really qualified for anything else. Or you don't know what else you could do. There are very real barriers for a lot of people in their employment options. Single mothers that need flexible schedules or need a certain amount of money. New immigrants to this country, maybe they were professionals in their home country, but now they're working in laborer jobs because their credentials don't work in the United States. Undocumented immigrants. Family caretakers who have restrictions about the hours that they can work. You name it, there are many real barriers to finding the work that you love and to loving your work. But some of these barriers of our own making. Fears, inhibitions, inertia. Money is a big one. A friend of mine who worked for the feds as one of her first jobs told me that she met a man in her early career there who said, I hate my job every single day, but in 15 years I can retire with a full pension. This same friend had always wanted to start her own business, but she was afraid of the insecurity. She had a secure job, pension plan, and this really held her back from taking this risk, for following this dream she had of her own business. She was telling someone that, you know, if I only knew I was going to have enough money. And another friend challenged her, well, how will you know when you have enough? And made her realize that she wouldn't know when she had enough. It was more about taking the risk, more about accepting that she was stepping out of this secure job and following her dream. I followed a dream about 6 or 7 years ago now. I knew in my mid-30s that I wanted to be a minister, but it took me 15 years to decide to do it, because there were so many good reasons not to do it. I had a good job. I was making good money. I had a really nice pension. I kept reinvesting in my work, telling myself I could find the meaning that I was looking for in what I was doing at the time. And fear held me back, fear that I was too old, fear that no one would hire me, fear that I wouldn't have enough money when I was old. But at one point, I got to the point where my psyche, my spirit, could not let me not do it anymore. It was too uncomfortable not to do it. The call was too strong. And when I left my job where I'd been for 25 years, people said, "Oh my gosh, you're so lucky." People that maybe were a couple of years older than me, "I need to work 5 more years before I can retire. You're so lucky." And I am lucky. I was born into a middle-class family. I have a good education. I have a lot of privilege in this world. I don't have some of the barriers that a lot of people have to following their dreams. But luck had nothing to do with my choice to leave my career and go into the ministry. It was a choice. It was an investment in my belief that I should live my life to the fullest. These days, when high school graduates or kids going into college, there's this equation of you already have to know what you want to do, what you want to be when you're 18, when you're 20. Your major has to match. Well, what are you going to do with that major? A lot of pressure to find out, figure out what you want to do, what you want to be. But you know, there's some people who don't quite figure that out when they're 20. There's some people that don't figure it out when they're 40. There's some people, myself included, who don't finally figure it out until they're 50. If this is your situation, you're not comfortable with what you're doing, it's not fulfilling you, but you don't know what else there is for you, you don't know what you're called to do, I would encourage you to listen to what feeds your spirit. Listen to where your spirit is flourishing in the workplace and where it's shut down. Where your spirit is flourishing in your life and where it shut down. I know that many of you in the congregation are retired, but you'd probably agree that we all need to work. We all need something to do. Marge Piercy poem says that a person cries out for work that is real. We spend most of our time at work. If you look at the chunks of our lives, we spend more time at work than almost anything else, except maybe sleeping. So what is it that people want at work? Well, most people want some sense of control about how they do their jobs. People want to believe that their work matters, that what they do makes a difference. They want some sense of camaraderie, that they're working with others to make something happen. And people want room for creativity or personal expression in their work. Some people have this. Some people have that whole list. But many people are in jobs that are too small for their spirits. There's a book that I read called All the Live Long Day. It's about assembly line workers and how they make their work, how they survive their work. And it's fascinating how people that, you know, let's say they do something like sorting out rotten beans off a conveyor belt in a bean canning factory, they play little games with themselves, or they have competitions with their coworkers, or they find ways to keep the day from being unbelievably boring. When I was thinking about this, what makes work meaningful part, the TV show Dirty Jobs came to my mind. Has anybody seen that TV show? It's on the Discovery Channel. So there's this guy, Mike Rowe, and he goes out, people write in about their jobs. He goes out and he finds the most really horribly disgusting jobs that exist. And he goes there and he does that job with those people. Whatever it is, let's say it's cleaning out a sewer line cleaners, right? I mean, that's up there in the dirty job category. And so he does their work, and he does this wonderful job of honoring them by, you know, really kind of reacting to how horrible it is and respecting the fact that they do it, respecting their skill level, respecting their commitment. And what I see in episode after episode on that show is those things that make work worthwhile. People cleaning out the sewer line have a sense of camaraderie in their team. They have problems they have to solve, and they work together to solve them. They use their creativity to solve them. And they feel satisfaction at the end of the day when the project is done. Now, I would never want to clean out a sewer line, but I have to say that sounds like it has a lot of qualities of a job that would be fulfilling. Now, those of us who work in bureaucracies or have worked in bureaucracies know that it's often hard to find some of those qualities in a bureaucracy, particularly to find meaning in the thing that you do. You know, you review the documents to ensure that policy 39 is followed in criteria 12. It's kind of hard to get it up every day to believe that that work contributes to the world. Bureaucracies are particularly challenging, and in particular because they're not inherently human. If they're a corporation, a for-profit corporation, they're there to make money for the shareholders. Or if it's in government, they're there to serve the policies and the procedures of the agency to meet the needs of whatever programs the government is offering. But because these organizations aren't human and don't always have human goals, they can be very dehumanizing for the workers. So if you're in one of those situations, a corporate world or a bureaucratic world, what can you do? What are your options? Well, the first thing you need to do is hold on to your humanity and hold on to whatever power that you have. And I think one of the most significant powers that you have are the choices about how you're going to act in that environment. And your ability to resist being complacent, resist negativity that you may see in your bosses or in other workers, resist treating people badly because of your own frustration, resist being defined by the situation of your job, resist letting other people create a reality for you. All that resistance takes a bit of energy, takes a bit of spirit. So where does that come from? Where does that source come from? Well, it all starts with self-esteem. This book, Hard at Work, probably one of my favorites of the 10 books or so that I read in preparation for this service, is all about self-esteem. Every single word in this entire book is about self-esteem. Feeling that you're worthy of being treated humanly, feeling that you're worthy of being respected, worthy of being happy. Self-esteem is at the core of all of that. Feeling that you deserve to have a job that is meaningful and feeds your spirit. There's been a lot in the news about the minimum wage, and I was struck by how it's not a living wage, how it's not even close to being a living wage. I was struck by the McDonald's workers, was it in Chicago? Some of you may know more than I do about this, where a group of workers, and maybe it's nationwide, people at McDonald's who were striking and trying to raise awareness of their desire to have a living wage. Stepping outside their fear, having the courage to speak up to the world to say, we work hard, we deserve to be paid a wage that we can live on. Or other simple things like a lot of companies now do this on-call scheduling so you never know until 9 o'clock the night before whether you're going to work the next day. People saying, I want to be able to have a life where I can make choices about what I can do and I'm not being held in suspense by your need to have me there only when you need me. I think about the farm workers under Cesar Chavez and people in other challenged work situations who rise up and say, we deserve to be treated fairly. We deserve a fair wage and fair treatment. That's some serious resistance from people who are not in a very powerful place. Oftentimes in our work situations, we do feel powerless. But I would say to you that even if you feel powerless, don't hand over the power that you have. Don't hand over your identity or your self-worth. Own that for yourself fully. Viktor Frankl, a well-known author who speaks about his experience of the Holocaust, says that everything can be taken from a human, but one thing, the last of human freedoms. to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. I think that's one of the powers that we do have in the workplace, the power over our own attitude, the power over what we say and how we act and how we treat others. And I would tell you in particular that no matter how miserable you are at your job, do not let your unhappiness compromise your integrity. Passive-aggressive behavior, slowing down the work, stealing from your company, justifying things that when you're in a more positive frame of mind, you would have the strength of will not to justify, is not going to serve you in any way. And I think we should all take a look at how we're contributing to our situation at work, how we, our attitude and our behavior might be part of the solution for us. In a job I had years ago, I'd been there for a while and it was not a great environment. And we got a new boss and I was very excited and invigorated about the possibility. And this boss started hiring new people who did what I did, but made more money than I did, and were treated better than I was. And I was expected to train these people. And I was so shocked that I never perceived myself as anything other than an active employee, but suddenly I was fit in with one of the bureaucratic drones who was negative and resistant to change. I found myself getting very angry and resentful. And I kept playing this negative, sad, negative, resentful story in my head over and over again until I really checked out of my job. And my negative thoughts consumed a lot of my time, not just my time at work. The night before, before I'd go to bed at night, I'd cry because I had to go back to that job in the morning. I started getting paranoid that no one else would hire me, that I was going to be stuck in that job for the rest of my life. And then one day, I was sitting at my desk, and I heard noises outside my office and activity, and I realized that I was creating this little negative bubble. I was creating this force field that was keeping me stuck in this negativity, that my bosses and coworkers weren't even participating in it at all, that I was serving as my own jailer by perpetuating this negativity. I took on this identity and held myself from being fully engaged, seeing myself as a victim and reinforcing this victimhood with every opportunity, every slight, every bad treatment that I could perceive. And the other part of that lesson for me was the recognition that I shouldn't be sitting around at my desk waiting for somebody else to validate me, somebody to recognize my abilities. You know, we've got so many of these stories in our culture of how, you know, you do something and then some, oh my God, Lucy, that was the best memo ever written in the history of our company. We will now promote you to chief memo processor. Right? We have fantasies that will be saved. But you can't wait for that validation before finding satisfaction in your work, before finding your own self-worth. It's your job to do that. It's your role because no one knows you better than you. So I have a new work hero. This is a man that I saw at the Arden Fair Mall. I was at the food court at the Arden Fair Mall. And there was a man there in his 40s or 50s, a little graying around the temples. And he was the fellow who cleaned up the food court from the people that were eating there, the people who would leave their trays around, the man who picked up the trash and cleaned off the tables. And he had the most dignity that I have ever seen in any worker. He had this sense of purpose in what he did. He seemed to care tremendously about the quality of his work. He seemed to hold himself with high self-esteem and integrity. And I thought, if he can do that, cleaning the tables at the Arden Fair food court, I can do that in whatever challenge that I'm offered, whatever work situation that I've given. Give my best self to it. Hold myself. Hold my dignity. Hold on to my integrity. And hold on to your dreams. All these books, I think one of the most meaningful part of all these books are the stories about people who've changed their lives. Stories about people who felt that they were worth having a better life, that their spirit deserved a job that was big enough to hold everything that they were. Maybe one of those stories in the books will resonate for you, but don't let go of your dreams for a better life. And if you don't know what those dreams are, then let yourself dream. Listen to your heart. Follow where your spirit leads. Believe that you are worth more. For this is your life. This day, this week, this job. And as far as I know, we don't get another one. May it be so.